No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS.
You're with George Eliason,
live from Donbash, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason. Welcome back. Now, today we have a very special guest, award-winning journalist Eva Bartlett, who's done a lot of stellar work in Syria. She exposed the white helmets, the volunteers that were doing absolutely nothing but stage events in Syria, as well as the ISIS use of chemical weapons in Syria and blaming it on the Syrian government. Eva, welcome aboard.
Hey, George. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. Now, Eva's been doing a lot of work in Ukraine, in Donbas, for the last few years. She's been reporting here since 2019. Now, you were in Donetsk and Gorlovka for the first time in 2019. What was it like back then?
Yeah, I went to areas around Gorlovka and between Gorlovka and Donetsk. So I went to a village called Mine 67 and another village very close to these areas that I visited were all around five or 600 meters from Ukrainian forces. I was told by the press officer that accompanied me. He's actually a fantastic journalist. He's gone back to doing war journalism, Dmitry Astrakhan. In any case, he accompanied me and he translated for me. He was excellent, a lot of help. Anyway, so we went to Mine 67, Zaitsevo, I think it was called Kruta Balka, and one other area, and whose name eludes me, but in all the areas we saw houses that were either minorly damaged, but I don't think it's fair to say minorly damaged because a lot of them have repeatedly had their windows blown out, for one thing, have cracks in the walls or have more substantial damage, have damage to the roof, and a lot of other houses that were completely burned out from Ukrainian shelling or from, I was told when I visited one, Krutovalka, that even heavy machine gun firing, can cause a house to light a fire and the house can burn out. So anyway, what I saw was a variety of houses in it, different stages of destruction. And the people remaining who I met, there might have been younger people, but the most of the people I met were elderly. And they had nowhere to go because I would ask them, you know, why do you stay? And they would reply, where would I go? And they also said that Ukrainian shelling was on a daily or rather nightly basis, that they did also shell during the day, but primarily it was heavily in the evening after the OSCE observers would leave. And they said, you know, once it got dark, you can't be on the street. It's very dangerous. And they were shelling with, this was the specifics were told to me again by Dmitry, who knows his weaponry. And I've heard this and I've read this since. So it's not just his words making things up, but that Ukraine was using heavy weaponry that was prohibited under Minsk to shell these houses, to terrorize these people. And the OSCEs largely wasn't doing a whole lot. They were lodging their reports, but, you know, frankly, I think it was quite watered down. And since then, maybe you can speak to this too, we've learned that the OSCEs was indeed helping Ukraine in their targeting of the Donbass residents. But in any case, I saw houses in a variety of disarray, people who had been terrorized for years. I met another elderly couple who at the time had been living in the basement of a school for around 6 years. And the school was itself badly shot up and the basement was dingy, it stunk, there was, you know, very poor ventilation. And as I recall, I think the elderly man was handicapped in a wheelchair. Their circumstances were pretty dire in terms of mobility, in terms of where they were living. And I did also speak with some of the defenders of the DPR, Western corporate media would call them separatist militants or something like that. They are often referred to as the People's Militia, and I like to call them the defenders of the DPR, because when I spoke with them, most of the ones I spoke with said, you know, before all this started back in 2014, we had normal jobs. Some of us were miners, some of us were truckers, et cetera, et cetera. And they were forced to take up arms to defend their people, their families. And that's not a narrative you'll hear in Western media. You'll hear all sorts of pejoratives describing them. Of course, it will always be Russian-backed, as if that's a bad thing in the first place. But anyway, they will never actually give them the same sort of nobility and heroic status that they afforded terrorists in Syria, you know? So anyway, that's some exactly of what I've seen in 2019.
Now, back then, you know, the situation for people was bad. How was the humanitarian situation? Were they getting help? Did they talk about that at all?
See, I didn't directly see that myself, but after going there, I became familiar with different social media accounts that were focused exclusively on events in the Donbass. And so I'm aware of individuals that took it upon themselves to raise funds and take humanitarian supplies to families in hard-hit areas, clothing and toys to children. But as for organized efforts, I can't really speak to that. I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Has the attitudes of the people in DPR, Donetsk People's Republic, has it changed radically since you've been, you know, have you noticed that any changes in 2022?
It's hard for me to say. You know, I'm the first to admit that I don't speak Russian, and I'm only starting to understand bits. So, you know, I am reliant on other people to inform me about what's being said, whereas in Syria I can conduct conversations on my own in Arabic. So it's hard for me to really give that a proper answer. I would say, in my opinion, if there were people that were kind of apolitical and on the fence, back in 2019 or before, given the intensity of the Ukrainian shelling, it was already bad then, but, you know, it's, as you know well, living where you live, you're exposed to it as well. And I would imagine, given the intensity, that any sort of fence sitting, if there was any, of people declaring themselves apolitical, I would imagine that has to be gone now, because Ukraine has just been going insane the past, not even just the past week. You can probably speak better to this again because you live here and I'm only visiting for a few weeks. But I have to imagine that there's, when I was there in 2019 and I would ask people about their opinions on the political aspect of it and would they, you know, what do they think about Ukraine? And one guy was like, why would we ever go back to live in Ukraine? Our lives under Ukraine was terrible to begin with, you know, in terms of corruption and the state not providing a whole lot for the people. But then after being the recipient of Ukrainian shelling for so many years, he said absolutely not, he wouldn't go back. But by this point, you know, I have to imagine, too, with all the videos that have come out of how, you know, contrary to how Russia and Donbass forces treat prisoners of war, which is humanely and giving them clothing, a warm place and food and water, we've seen enough of these horrific videos from the Ukrainian forces, whether they're the Ukrainian, you know, various armies themselves or the Nazi battalions, of them killing and mutilating Russian prisoners of war. So I have to imagine these combined factors would mean that I'm guessing, because again, the language barrier, that people here are fully supportive of the Russian military operation and the efforts to restabilize the entire Donbass area.
Now, you know, in light of what you said, the next question is going to sound a little odd, but it needs to be asked anyway. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence Ukraine is trying to spare civilian lives in DPR anywhere?
Absolutely not. I do not see that. I do not see that. I can't, because, you know, I know you're aware of this, but for your listeners, And we're just referring to recent events. And if you want to chime in and go back months further, but just starting with, let's say, just start with, I will go back, but we'll start with June 13th, because as you know, that was a day of unprecedented Ukrainian shelling of Donetsk and surrounding areas. And even DPR leadership said, like, this is, if not the worst, some of the worst, I'm paraphrasing, that we've had since 2014. And everybody made clear here, and I saw some examples with my own eyes, that the targets were not military, they were completely civilian. So what I saw with my own eyes after the fact, of course, but was a busy market in Donetsk that was targeted, just like I saw in April, by the way, when I was here, another market that was targeted in western Donetsk that killed five civilians, and two bodies were still lying in the streets of the market when I went there. But this, on June 13th, Ukrainian forces targeted market. They targeted various hospitals and schools and apparently a kindergarten. And I saw one of the hospitals the next day, and it was a maternity hospital, you know. And we have to, both of us, emphasize that we know very well that Ukraine and Western media have worked hand in hand to accuse Russia of various things that just simply never happened. And one of those notable things that never happened was Russia's airstrike, allegedly, in March. I believe it was in early March, allegedly, on a maternity hospital in Mariupol. And that just simply never happened. But this strike with a Uragan missile on a maternity hospital in Donetsk did happen. Thankfully, no women were killed because they were sheltering in the basement where they'd been sheltering the whole day because Ukraine had been shelling the whole day. But I mean, that's a prime example of absolutely not trying to prevent civilians from being injured or killed. And the fact that they're shelling central Donetsk like they did in mid-March when they released the Tuchka-U missile on a street that is a very central, as you know, very central Donetsk street in the, you know, prime hours of the day, when they knew most people would be there lined up at the ATM or other reasons to be on that central street. And they target it with one of these big Tuchka-U missiles filled with clusters. So there's contrary to any evidence that they're trying to spare lives and target military installations, they are not. They're doing the exact opposite.
When I saw the maternity hospital, there was one set of video. There's one baby that they couldn't move because it was in an incubator.
Uh-huh.
And so a couple people had to stay, you know, on that floor with them. And you can see the debris from the explosions around the incubator. But they can't disconnect it or the baby will die.
Oh my goodness.
So, I mean, that's just how crazy this is.
See, I didn't know about that, George. And now if we step back and imagine that this whole scenario was a hospital in Kiev, just imagine how much for weeks we would hear about this blasting
exactly.
off of CNN, etc.
Now, from talking to people there, going through the market, going to the hospital, from your interviews, do these people that just went through this seem resigned to fate, or are they more determined to survive and have a future after the war, knowing Russia is taking the lead role protecting them?
Oh, actually, now that's a very good point in your question, because where was it? I saw on one of the Telegram channels, I'm sorry, I can't give you an exact name which channel, but it was showing a photo or a video of a huge number of DPR, I think it was, citizens lined up to receive Russian citizenship or apply for. Anyway, the point being, keen to become Russians. So that indicates a hope for the future, you know, because if they didn't have hope, they wouldn't bother to do that. But on the other hand, you know, having lived 3 years in Gaza over the span of 5 years from 2008 to March 2013, and experienced and witnessed horrific atrocities by Israel against the civilian population of Gaza, I know, and also, of course, all my time in Syria, I know what it's like for people to, for war to become a normal thing for people not to flinch, including myself, but I'm talking about the people, the civilian population, not to flinch when they hear a bomb, you know, because it's just so normal.
It's really important to get people to understand that, because I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. I mean,
please go on.
Yeah. Well, so like, and I'm not in any sense trying to be condescending to people's experiences that have never perhaps experienced a war zone, but I just want to give an example. If you're on a busy street and a car backfires and it's a loud explosion sound, you jump, right? And now, for people who've never experienced proximity to a bomb, whether it's a grenade or any of these mortars or missiles or larger missiles and rockets or F-16, like I think they're one-ton bombs that Israel drops on homes in Gaza. If you haven't experienced any of that, of course, you know, it's hard to imagine how terrifying that sound is. Now, if you could just imagine that, just imagine it being an incessant sound. It's just in Gaza, like the F-16ing is incessant. We just don't hear about it, but I know from experience it's incessant. And people just learn to live with it. They learn that this massive thud sound that means the destruction of a building and the people within, if they're in the house, is just normal. And it's really, really a psychological
becomes the background.
It becomes the background, but it also messes with your psychology, right? Because mm-hmm. that should not be normal.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be normal for people here. Like, as I've said, the past few days, Ukraine has been shelling Donetsk intensively. And actually, I went to Gorlovka on Saturday. As you know, I keep saying, as you know, I'm sorry, people. I don't know why I'm doing that today. But as you do know, because we were talking about it, I went to Gorlovka because I didn't know, first of all, that Ukraine was going to be shelling Donetsk on Saturday more than usual. And I felt like I wanted to go back to Gorlovka because I'd been there in 2019. And I also felt like there wasn't a lot of media attention on Gorlovka. But then the day I choose to go there, Donetsk comes under, you know, intense shelling. So I did come back here, but there was shelling still in Gorlovka. I met somebody who I'd met in 2019 who had shown me the sites of a horrific series of bombings in, I believe it was 2016, that became known as Bloody Sunday in Gorlovka because of the it just targeted the center of the city and killed tens of civilians. So I met with this person and talked about how things were, and he was saying, like, yeah, the shelling is continuous. And indeed, when I was there, I could hear it was like sometimes it was every minute, sometimes it was every 4 minutes, sometimes it was every 30 seconds, but it wasn't as loud. It seemed to be on the perimeter of the city that day on Saturday, whereas in Donetsk they were hearing it all over the and experiencing it all over the city. And then I came back here early Sunday morning, and the shelling does continue. And I'm going to get back to your question, George, but then my friend in Gorlovka said, now they're attacking the center of the city. So it ebbs and flows, but it's consistent. And like you said, it's a background sound for people. And when I went out to get water yesterday, I went through one of the underground passages, which people, by the way, use as a bomb shelter when Ukraine's shelling intensifies if they're out in the street. Thankfully, that's some sort of structure they can hopefully be protected by. But I saw an old lady selling flowers sitting at the top of the stairs of this underground passageway. And I just thought, my God, I gave her money. And I just thought, like, I wish she would go home. But of course, she's not going to, because this has become normal, and she's on that street trying to sell her flowers so that she can exist, right? And I see many people like that, and people like just around 3:30, I think it was, there was a pretty loud explosion, and then I think it was somewhere to the east of the city center, and I saw a plume of smoke. And I looked out on the street, and there's just people normally standing there waiting for the bus, you know, and I'm not laughing at that. It's, you know, you don't know what to say. You despair at the situation where it is so normal that they just don't flinch and they continue with their day. And unfortunately, with the way that Ukraine is targeting the city, some of these people going about their days will become casualties.
And that's, you know, you've really captured the essence of it in that too, because when everything started in 2014 at Pravi Sector, my first introduction to it was we went to a market in another city. We came back. On the way back, you see military helicopters flying by you. I'm like, uh-oh. Well, we get back, I get off a bus, and right sector drives by with heavy weapons. And like, oh, they're here. They're here. And then all of a sudden, you go out and you go out in the back, and it's continuous gardens. It's everybody's gardens, right? So it's like a big field. And you look at one side, and back then it was very unorganized. Ukraine was using hunting rifles for sniper rifles. So it wasn't military scopes or anything. And they were leaning them up against bushes. And you could see the glint off the scopes. And I'm like, there's a sniper over there. And you look on the other side, there's a sniper over there. So I tell my neighbor, and this, I remember this was the first day we saw this. And I tell my neighbor looks and she's like, and runs into the house. Well, 3 days later, the scopes are still there. They're still visible. They're driving heavily armed vehicles down the street. They've got, you know, heavy machine guns on the street, okay, at the stores and stuff. And people are, within 3 days, 4 days, everybody in town had adjusted and it became background. And the shelling at that time was nonstop. Mm-hmm. It was just nonstop. And I mean, it was just crazy. But yeah, you have to try to make some sense of it. You know, it's a coping skill, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very bizarre. And, you know, you've went through this for how long? You've been in war zones for like forever. It shouldn't have to be that way, but
it shouldn't. And if I can just give maybe two anecdotes to add on to what you're saying. So in the in late 2008, Israel began its 3 week massacre of the people of Gaza, who at that time numbered under 2 million. But bearing in mind, Gaza is an incredibly densely packed place. There are no bomb shelters. Maybe the resistance have bomb shelters, but the people don't. And that's not me blaming the resistance. I'm just saying factually, they don't exist. And so people at best, if they had a basement, would shelter in the basement, otherwise shelter in staircases, under staircases. Otherwise, they wouldn't shelter at all. You know, they just, I don't know. So at that time, on the 27th of December, around noon, it might have been 11:30, Israel dropped, like, I forget the number. I feel like it was 100. It was a huge number of massive bombs dropped by airplanes, not you know, like incredible damage all at once. So chaos was created all at once. So everybody was in a state of chaos because while there had been routine Israeli bombings in the lead up to this and a routine sonic booms, which are the equivalent of a bombing, but just audio, but still terrifying. This was like a sudden bombardment that targeted all over Gaza. And then, so I guess my point was like, at first everybody was like, oh shit, like don't walk past that building because that could be a target and don't walk down that street because it's been hit once and it could be hit again. But after a few days, it was like, well, you know what? Everything's a target now, so just stop detouring and just use the same street that was already targeted and could be targeted again because there's no place that's not been targeted. And similarly, like with the drones overhead, now I don't know if people have – well, most people have probably heard a drone, like the kind of drones that you can send up to take video footage. But I'm talking the kind of drones that drop bombs. And when you have this this chaos of drones up in the sky – it's a psychologically horrible sound because there's so many of them and you know what they're capable of doing. At first, again, we were like, okay, don't go out at night because if you go out at night, they're just going to strike anything that moves. But then after a while, it was like, well, you know what? I want to, because then I was an activist at the time and there were, I forget the number, but maybe five or six of us international activists. And we started riding in the ambulances of Palestinian medics to document Israel's war crimes. And at some point, you know, I was like, well, you know what? A couple of friends and I were like, we need to change our clothes. It's disgusting, you know? So you reach the point where even though the drones are overhead, it's like, you know what? I'm just going to risk it because I could die in the ambulance. I could die walking down the street, whatever, you know? So unfortunately it's not a fatalistic, I don't think necessarily, maybe it is a little bit fatalistic, but it's more like just coming to terms with the fact that, yeah, you could die at any moment, but you're not going to stop living. So then choosing to do things like walk down a street at night to get to your apartment in order to change your clothes instead of cower in a stairwell somewhere, you know. So that this is the kind of normalization that does occur. And I remember, which is one more anecdote, was one night we went out, I was out with a medic to try to retrieve any survivors of a high school that had been bombed by Israel at night. And these Palestinian medics are heroes. They're working with bare bones ambulances and bare bones equipment. But we had F-16s and drones all over the sky, you know, and they didn't have proper searchlights. So eventually we had to call it quits and go back at dawn. And we did find a corpse, and they brought the corpse to take it to the morgue. And as they walked the corpse to the ambulance, past people who'd gathered to see what was going on, I just remember this one kid who must have been like 7 or 8, just standing there watching calmly, kind of nonchalantly, as this body was marched by, this burned body. And the kid was totally nonplussed, you know, he was munching on a sandwich. And I'm not commenting on the kid, I'm just saying it should not be normal for him to see that, you know. And unfortunately, exactly. It is. And I have to imagine it's similar here in the Donbass.
It is, because you've had children, you know, 8 years old. They don't know anything about this.
Yeah.
Now, we've got to take a break, and we'll pick this up right after the break. Okay, Eva?
Sounds good. Thanks, George.
All right. This is George Eliason with TNT Talk Radio. I'll see you after the break.
Dolores Cahill on TNT Radio.
Maybe give us some synopsis of the research that you've been working, particularly around the various histopathological and histological and molecular changes that you saw, because I think this is very important if people nowadays are in a situation and they want to prove that their environment or their work environment is affecting them.
To begin with, the situation here in Sweden is somewhat different to what other countries, because here, electrohypersensitivity is an officially fully recognized functional impairment. So, as a person with a disability, you don't need to prove anything. And this means that a person with electrohypersensitivity is not a patient. He or she is not ill. The patient is the toxic environment.
Weekends with Dolores Cahill on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is it. Your chance to come face to face with a Royal Marines Commando. They've set you a mission, so you will need to listen to the following instructions very carefully. Meet at the rendezvous. The Royal Marine Commandos will be there waiting for you. Locate them, talk to them, and learn about what it takes to become a Royal Marines Commando. To find out more details about this secret mission, call 0117 926 0233. Got that? 0117 926 0233. However, you should be aware, complete this mission and your future missions will be a lot more challenging. Royal Marine Commandos. 99.99% need not apply.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is where you get your daily ration of high-velocity conversation. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason, and I'm really honored to have award-winning journalist Eva Bartlett with me today. Now, Eva, when we left off, we were talking about how people normalize living in a war situation with all the destruction, all the danger around them. And you were talking about, you know, that small boy seeing that child, seeing the body being moved. You know, I'd have to say that, you know, with the kids here, it's a lot of the same. You know, you see pictures and videos, or you actually see it in person, children playing with fragments of bombs. in, you know, in their yards, because that's where the bombs or the shells or the rockets fell. It's just that crazy. So, you know, this is it's tough because it's becoming a lot more common experience these days, I guess. Now, you on your it was your second trip this year into DPR that you went to Mariupol, or your first?
Yeah, my second trip this year. Yeah, you're right. Okay. in April.
Now, going into the city, now you've been to Gaza, you were there, you were in Syria, okay, and you saw all, you lived with the destruction that was going on there. What was your first impression entering Mariupol? Can you paint it for our listeners?
Well, I mean, I expected there to be destruction because I was aware of the fighting that had occurred and was still occurring at the time with regards to the Azov Nazis that were holed up in the Azovstal plant. And there were still, I believe there were airstrikes on the Azovstal plant. I'm not 100% sure they were airstrikes, but they were loud strikes. But and unfortunately, you know, there were apartment buildings that like 5-6 maybe 7-story apartment buildings that the upper floors were darkened. So that meant there had been most likely firing on them and the fires had erupted inside. There was destruction not only in the upper floors, but I'm making a point here. And that is that, yes, there's destruction and it's not a pretty sight to see. And yes, I've seen that in Syria. But what I learned from fellow journalists and then from having seen testimonies taken by people who went there, you know, during the fighting and before I went there, and what I learned from meeting people since, civilians since, is the primary reason that there's so much destruction there, particularly when you see these buildings that have been attacked, you can see like upper floors really burnt out, is the primary reason for that is that the Ukrainian forces, whether they were the actual Ukrainian army or the Nazis that embedded intermixed with the Ukrainian army, would occupy the top floors of residential buildings. And in many cases, they would keep civilians hostage as human shields on the lower floors. I'm not a military expert, but I think common knowledge is that when a military is fired upon, they will return fire to that source. And the Ukrainian military and Nazis were firing from not only from apartment buildings, but also elsewhere and in Mariupol and elsewhere in the DPR and in your region too, in the Lugansk People's Republic, firing from schools, from hospitals, from civilian infrastructure. So I saw a lot of destruction, and it's just incredibly notable that, as they did in Syria, mainstream media, Western corporate funded and owned media, never give any context that I've just been trying to give as to why there's destruction. And there's also the added context that in some cases, or maybe many cases, Ukrainian forces themselves fired on buildings, either to create like a false flag kind of setting where they could then incriminate Russia, or for terrorism. I don't know, because I know that they have booby-trapped buildings. In fact, I was in Mariupol some days ago watching Russian sappers show us how they do their work and how they check buildings for booby traps that might have been left behind by Ukrainian forces. So, for example, they might put a grenade above a door sill and then have a wire going down, an invisible like fishing thread or something, going down to a point on the bottom of the door so that once you walk through that door, you'll trigger the grenade and it will explode and you'll be killed. That's one example. Or they might leave mines underneath scrap metal that you walk over in, amidst all the destruction. So anyway, the point being, there's many sources of the destruction that we see in places like Mariupol. And yes, you can attribute a good degree of that to Russian and DPR forces, but you also have to give that context as to what they were fighting and why there would be fire towards apartment buildings. Because you can travel in other areas of Mariupol, if you want to believe this Western-spun narrative that Russia was just wantonly destroying buildings in Mariupol, why only in some areas? Why didn't they do it in other areas of Mariupol, right? And also just logically, if we know that people in Mariupol are ethnically Russian for the most part and identify as Russians, and now we're seeing, as we were saying earlier, not only in Mariupol, but like throughout areas that have been, as people here say, and I agree with the terminology, liberated from Ukrainian forces, we see people scrambling to get Russian passports, Russian citizenship. So then why then, logically, would Russia want to target its own people? Why would it want to target infrastructure that after the war is over and the flames have settled, it will be Russia helping the Donbass people rebuild? It doesn't make any logical sense, just like when we talk about the alleged chemical attacks in Syria. It doesn't make any sense that the Syrian army would be targeting civilians, of which the army had, family members and relatives in those areas being targeted. And it doesn't make any sense that the Syrian army would intentionally destroy its own infrastructure, which Syria then has to have rebuilt. You know, it's just not logical. So I wish people would employ critical thinking in that regard. So, yeah, there's destruction. Then when we spoke with civilians, again, time after time, we heard corroborated, yes, we were kept in basements. In many cases, now I didn't take these testimonies, but I've seen a number of them via other journalists of civilians saying the Ukrainian forces wouldn't allow them to leave, would fire upon them when they tried to leave. And this is something that happened over and over in Syria by terrorists occupying civilian areas.
Now, when you got there, the siege was still going on. What was your read on people during this time frame? Were they? Was there a sense of, you know, what we described earlier, normalizing war? Now, you could either see this as, okay, Russia's here, Azov is being pushed out, so things are going to get better. Or Russia's here, Ukraine's going to get pushed out, so things are going to get worse. What was your read on the people during this time frame? Were they more upbeat because even though all this is going on around them?
No, I have to say again, like, so in April I went to Mariupol, I think it was 2 days. So I was with Roman Kosarov, an RT journalist, and he's been valiantly taking humanitarian aid to these people, these types of people that are desperately in need, right? So these are people that had been living in basements. Yeah, really a huge heart. And of his own accord, like, this is not a Russian government initiative, although they do, of course, they do provide humanitarian aid vastly throughout the Donbass. But this is Roman's initiative. And then he's quite humble. So he's the first to say, like, I'm not the only one doing this. A lot of Russians, a lot of Donbass people are doing this because we care. But anyway, so I wanted to go to Mariupol to meet people and if possible take their testimonies and hear what they'd been through, but that's why I was there with him in those areas, because he was delivering humanitarian aid. And so the people we met were people very much in need of the basics of life. They probably hadn't bathed in weeks, if not much longer than that. So they would be filthy. They would be in need of things like wet wipes just to, you know, at least clean their faces and their hands. And they were very much in need of just basic food supplies and water. So, no, I wouldn't say that I was met with any people that were, like, extremely jubilant. I did see some people. I did see some people that were surprisingly more upbeat than you would expect, but most people honestly were just trying to survive. I'm sure they were glad that they no longer had to shelter in basements and have Ukrainian forces above them and have the bombing occurring around them, but I didn't see a gleefulness at that time. Now, I have gone back since, and you'll see street markets have popped up. So they're as you would see in, we wouldn't see them so much in the West, right? But basically, literally just people bringing whatever they can sell to a particular street and all amassing and selling, whether it's food or clothing or whatever. And so I've been back a few times since then, including, I forget how many days ago. And I'm seeing more and more of that throughout the city. And when I went to Mariupol to where the Russian sappers were working, and that was right near Azovstal. I also was starting to see or seeing the start of some cleaning up the debris there, because there is a lot of debris there. And one other thing, by the way, when I was there, so, you know, we talked with the sappers, they explained their work, they detonated an explosive to show the type of work they do. They showed us the nature of the booby traps, which, by the way, is something terrorists did in Syria as well, leaving booby traps to inflict more death and maiming on civilians and also military. But while I was there, like, I had a lot of time there. So I was walking around and saw a school that had clearly been militarized, the way that the windows were shuttered, you know, with boxes to provide some sort of cover, empty boxes that would have had some sort of weapons or ammunition in them. So the school was militarized. And I can't say definitively who did it, but I mean, almost certainly it was Ukrainian forces, because the Russians would have had, and the Donbass forces would have had no need to militarize a school. And we know very well, it's been documented time and time again, that Ukrainian forces have done so. Again, just like their counterparts, their terrorist counterparts in Syria did so. So that was interesting to see. I haven't published any of the photos or footage yet from there. I just haven't had time. But I mean, that just kind of ties in this whole narrative that is omitted from the West, that these people, these forces that the West are depicting as heroes defending the people of Mariupol were everything but heroes, you know, again, occupying civilian infrastructure, using people as human shields, and committing heinous acts of terrorism against people, torturing people. I don't have those testimonies myself, but I know you're aware of them through the various media you follow and Telegram channels you follow. And it's not a case of a one-off, some random Russian source said. It's testimonies just streaming out of there by people who have the ability to speak, you know, in Russian one-on-one with the civilians.
Now, did any of the people talk about the situation there they lived through over the last 8 years? Were you able to get a handle on that?
In Mariupol specifically, no, because I didn't have a fixer or a translator with me. And this is something I guess maybe listeners might not be aware, but a lot of journalists have a lot of money to spend on fixers and translators and everything else, and researchers and editors and all that. And you and myself and other independent people don't have that means. So, you know, I was relying on what I could, the interactions I could have while accompanying Roman. So unfortunately, again, if I was in Syria, I can speak Arabic and I could have walked up to random people and held conversations, but I wasn't able to have those conversations with people in Mariupol. But in other areas, in fact, I was in your neck of the woods with a small delegation of independent journalists it might have been early May. And we went to Kirovsk and we went to the area where the Idar had turned a factory into the Idar Nazis had turned a factory into a prison.
Right, the concentration camp, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty horrific. But in Kirovsk, the mayor there spoke to us, and also a really feisty, amazing, courageous journalist spoke to us, a woman who basically revamped the whole city's media from nothing to a pretty impressive media operation. Anyway, speaking to them, yeah, they were saying, you know, this has been the situation the past 8 years. We've been shelled relentlessly. It's increased since the military operation began. So for Mariupol, I can't say specifically, but I just know, you know, from consuming a lot of media from here and the interactions I have had, that their lives under Ukrainian shelling, obviously, were horrible. And from the media I've consumed from people who've interviewed residents of Mariupol and other areas that have been liberated, those that had interactions with Azov, obviously those were not... those were horrific interactions. And I just know also, like, when I went to Crimea in 2019 and talked with people there, they reiterated and emphasized that they wanted to join Russia, or as they were putting it, they wanted to return to Russia. And like, I remember this one woman I met, I was trying to find a cafe to charge my phone so I could use the map and walk to whatever accommodation I'd found. Anyway, she ended up driving me to accommodation. And as we drove, she spoke pretty good English and I was asking her questions. And one of the things she commented that I kept hearing when I was in Crimea was like, you know, under Ukraine, our infrastructure never developed and never improved. But since returning to Russia, we've had like so many, like I think she said 200 kindergartens opened in Crimea, and the roads have been improved. The transit has improved. The guy I was with, Vlad, a friend from the U.S., but he spends a lot of time in Russia and speaks fluent Russian. He was like, wow, when I was here in, I think it was 2014, these roads were horrible. They were so potholed and horrible. And now, like, it's night and day difference. So I'm just, I know we're talking about the Donbass and Mariupol, but I'm just making this point. These were areas that were under Ukrainian rule, right? And what the people there had to say was, our lives were horrible. Ukraine was corrupt. Infrastructure was decrepit. And so I have to imagine it was the same for people in Mariupol.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny you brought that up. I was here in 1991.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, actually, I was here when the day that everything went to hell in August 1991. I was flying out of Moscow going back. But in the city that I went to, it was where my wife's family was, the roads were brand new. Everything was brand, you know, the infrastructure was all brand new, all taken care of. Everything was pristine. And when I came back here, the first time I came back, no one had done anything with the roads all that time. And they'd never done any more improvements that whole time. So we're looking at 2009 from 1991. Okay. No one had done any improvements. Okay, that's just how bad it was. But that's how Kiev treated all of Donbass. Donbass was neglected, but if you go to West Ukraine, it's an entirely different story. I lived in West Ukraine for 2 years. The roads were kept pretty pristine over there. And it's just, that's their people. These are not their people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from 1991 till now, that's just how they looked at it, because they're Ukrainian and these are Russians. And so it was always second class citizenship, even though Donbass supplied a good chunk of the economy and income for Ukraine. They moved all the money to the West. They never looked after anybody here. Now, you said you went to the concentration camp. And now, we need to, we're going to forego the final commercial, and let's talk about this, because people actually need to hear about this. Walk us through it, please.
Mm-hmm. You want to do that now before commercial?
We're going to forego the commercial altogether. And
I see. Okay.
Take the time you need.
So it was a former meat processing factory, and in 2014, IDAR, one of the other infamous, I think it was, you can speak to this, George, but I think it's fairly notorious for its sadistic practices and torture of civilians. So they took it over, and they basically, there were structures in the building that had been used, as I understood, in the smoking of meat. So structures slightly wider than what I've seen in Syria on the solitary confinement cells that terrorists held Syrian civilians in. These rooms in the IDAR factory, IDAR concentration camp, as you aptly put it, were wider than that. But basically, two people were kept in one of these. They were turned into cells, and they had like a wire mesh grating on top that would have been used in its former use as a as a smoking room or something. Anyway, people were kept in these cells.
They weren't put in beds.
Yeah, they were forced to sleep on the floors for the first while, according to somebody we interviewed, without any sort of mattress. They weren't given any sort of anything. They were just thrown into a room. They were forced to urinate and defecate in the same space that they were being contained in. And then their torturers would practice sensory deprivation by walking above them and throwing cold water or cigarette butts or what have you on them whenever they seem to be falling asleep or blasting loud music. So that is, people might not realize how serious this sensory deprivation torture tactic is, but it is a severe form of torture. But in addition to that, they also practice bodily torture. They electrocuted people. They also did psychological torture where they would tie people up and then whack right next to their hands with an axe or something, and people never knew whether their hands were going to be smashed or fingers cut off. They would make them stand at a wall and fire above their heads and tell them they were going to be executed and that this was their last moments. So, you know, that is also psychological torture. And they would beat the hell out of them. And then they were starving them. I was told by one former inmate that they were given like a cup of water, a half cup of water a day, and just not given food at all. And they would basically torture and starve and beat them to the point where some of them, you know, would be so barely alive that then they would be given medical treatment just enough so that they seemed like a human being again before if there were some sort of prisoner exchange. So it was pretty horrific living circumstances, and these were not only for LPR soldiers but also primarily civilians. The people I spoke with, they said it's not known how many people were kept there. Records weren't kept, but there were a number of people who disappeared. So it's assumed that they were taken in the region. I mean, it's assumed they were taken to this this prison, this torture prison, and either killed or elsewise disappeared. But, you know, it's going to take time to, you know, excavate bodies if they are there to be excavated. But it was horrific. And the other element of being kept in that cell is that, so when I was there, it was, I think I said, early May. So it was getting warm. But even then, the guy that had been a former inmate made the point, like, it could be, you know, 25, 30 degrees outside. But inside, and this was in the basement level, it was cold. And they weren't given blankets. They weren't given anything. So if you imagine sitting like that for weeks or a month or longer than that, in the clothes that you had on, or maybe stripped of the clothes you had on, and then having cold water poured on you, and not being given anything warm, like it, that there were just multiple layers of torture, psychological torture and physical torture that these people endured. And even, you know, I know that Amnesty International is a tool of the empire, and they generally work hand in hand with the U.S. government. But even they in 2014 had to admit that Aydar was committing war crimes. And even Newsweek in the same year, 2014, compared their crimes to the crimes of ISIS. I mean, that says a lot about these thugs, these goons that were torturing civilians there.
Lugansk People's Republic's Deputy Foreign Minister Soroka was one of the first people in, and there were people in those cells, and unfortunately, one of them, now you can picture what Eva described. So you've got this grate that's at floor level, and the people are below floor level. So when they pour water on them, it's directly on their heads. One of them was a mother and a baby, and they were doing this. And when they got to her, the mother was still alive. The baby had passed away. The mother passed away a day later because of exposure, being soaked in those temperatures. And this had been going on for 8 years since they set this up. They were doing this to people. And, you know, what Eva's described, how do you compare a situation like that to anything except a Dachau and Auschwitz? They actually had a camp called Maidan, believe it or not. That was strictly torture, kill. How do you compare a military doing that to anything except that? Eva, we've got a couple of minutes left. Do you want to say anything before we finish up?
Well, again, I just want to thank you for having me on, and for I really appreciate what you've been doing journalistically, reporting here for so long, and you know, it's really an honor to know you. And then for listeners, like, I hope that people can get the gravity of what the people in Donbass not only have endured for 8 years, but the ramped up, intensified Ukrainian shelling. It's like they know no limits. They are absolutely targeting civilian infrastructure. They are not targeting military. And, you know, it's an effort for all of us to combat the Western media lies. But when you do find the Guardian or the BBC or whomever, usually their comments are closed. But when you do find them open, please hammer them with truth. And please do what you can to help educate people who might be sitting on the fence. Because the less people support mainstream media's lies and Ukraine's lies, you know, the better. And the more people understand that what Russia is doing here is actually helping civilians and not killing them, the better and the quicker this will all end.
Thank you so much, Eva, for coming. We've got about 20 seconds left, and I really want to thank you for taking the time for this. You really, you've gone a long way today opening up this situation in a very unique way. And I really, really appreciate that, because it gives people something to grasp, to hold on to.